Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. A man we have often looked to for advice on any number of aspects of what I think of as the war for the free world, but particularly a critical element of that war, particularly how it's being waged against us by the Chinese Communist Party, namely economic warfare, is our friend and colleague, Kevin Freeman. He is the host of his own television program, The Economic War Room, with Kevin Freeman on Blaze TV and other platforms. He is also the author of three terrific books, Secret Weapon, Game Plan, and According to Plan, and the proprietor of a really important entity. It's called the National Security Investment Consultants Institute, NSIC. And it's always a delight to have a chance to catch up with Kevin, even if oftentimes the tidings are not particularly good. His insights into them and certainly his recommendations about what we do about the challenges we're facing in the economic warfare space and more are always valuable. And we look forward to hearing from him at this moment. Kevin Freeman, it's good to have you back.
Hey, Frank, good to be with you.
I wanted to start by taking stock with you, if I could, Kevin, on the state of play with respect to China's economic warfare against us. It's a prime example of a phenomenon that, as you know, we talk about in our new book, The Indictment, and you have spoken of in your several books, the strategy of elite capture that the Chinese communists have engaged in to advance their unrestricted warfare against us, particularly in the financial sector, but the business community writ large. A fellow who has come to attention in recent days, thanks to our mutual friend Steve Bannon on his program War Room Pandemic, in which he spoke over the weekend with Brian Costello about a chap by the name of Neil Shen of Sequoia Capital. We'll be talking a little bit about this with Bill Walton shortly as well, but I'd like to get your take on who Neil Shen is, what role Sequoia Capital plays in, well, our economic life here in the United States, and who he actually works for.
Sure. Well, let's just step back a second and wonder, you know, how would you attack the greatest economy on the planet with the greatest military on the planet, the United States? In the book, you referenced unrestricted warfare, talks about infiltration. It talks about using economic weapons. It talks about all sorts of things. But wouldn't it make sense if you're a nation state with the market size of China that you would infiltrate? And in this case, I'm not even sure it's elite capture, but infiltrate the American markets, put people in high positions, for example, inside venture capital firms like Sequoia Capital, perhaps, or any of the other great venture capital firms. The result, if you did that, is you would have access to the best of American technology. You would be able to make winners and losers, and you would be, from that position, able to do the elite capture you described. So I'm not open for a lawsuit. I'm not going to go directly and say this is what Neil Shen is doing. But you look and there's so much, so many connections. For example, he comes from Chinese at Sequoia Capital. Sequoia Capital is tied to, you know, any number of companies. I even saw a reference to Dominion voting systems. And you wonder, wow, would that not be a position of power from which you could literally reshape the United States in your image, or take it down if you'd like, or redirect it to where you were in control and you infiltrated and put communist Chinese purposes throughout American corporations? That is the sort of position that Neil Shen has. He comes from China. And so you have to stop and wonder, is this possible? Could this be possible that he is a Chinese agent?
Well, the question that was raised by Brian Costello is not so much whether he's a Chinese agent, but that he's an asset of the Chinese Communist Party an employee, effectively. He works for them.
Almost duly contention. Employed, right? He says he's works both for Sekuoya Cap. But that would be the case whether it was formally announced or not. I mean, if you infiltrate, you are a Communist Chinese agent. You are employed by the Communist Party.
Well, in this case, and I can't remember the exact title of the enterprise that he's been affiliated with, but that he's been advising the Politburo of China on the business of venture capital and how to, you know, take advantage of access to it like he has, and the sources of funding that a guy in that position would be able to make possible, including, Kevin, as you've documented repeatedly, in places like companies that work directly for the People's Liberation Army. In other words, building weapons with which to attack Americans. This is the sort of thing that we've seen altogether too much of from a host of companies in the Wall Street financial sector space. And, you know, it's a formula for our undoing, I think, as you understand better than just about anybody.
Well, it gets that blatant. That's the problem here, is it's not no longer even hidden. You can pull out these direct links and you can show them and demonstrate them. American people just go, oh, ho-hum. The problem is and we alluded to it before we came on air, is that with Joe McCarthy, they made him to be the bad guy when he was rooting out communism here in the United States. And so we can't even talk about the enemy within any longer. And that's the problem we face. They make it that obvious, and you look like you're the bad guy if you point it out.
Now, Kevin, one of the other things that I think has been, you know, a vital service you have provided, both in your own role on Economic War Room, which I highly commend to this audience, and in your capacity with the National Security Investment Consultants Institute, is it would be one thing if the American people were simply being disserved by people aiding and abetting our mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. It's another if they're doing it with our own money. Talk a little bit about, as Brian Costello did the other day with Steve Bannon, the asset pools that a venture capital firm taps, including pension funds of people like steel workers and police and firefighters and teachers and so on, meaning that an awful lot of Americans may well be not only doing that aiding and abetting that I talked of, but also be exposing themselves to material risk that is not fully understood by them, especially in the event that we find ourselves in a shooting war with the Chinese Communist Party.
Well, it goes to the point that we make all the time. What we see as a marketplace, our enemies view as a battle space. The Chinese Communist Party has the ability to make any company highly successful and any venture fund highly successful just by granting favors or access to markets and so forth. And so our marketplace view is, hey, they're making money over here. Let's invest with them. It really is a tricky sort of thing that they pulled off, because they make these venture funds highly successful. You want to plow money into them, and then they use our money to build weapons aimed at us. It's evil in its purest form.
It is evil, and it is potentially murderously so. And that's the thing that I think Americans need to be aware of. And most especially this possibility that you could lose everything that is invested, not by you, but by your fund manager or BlackRock or Jamie Dimon or, you know, Neil Shen or somebody else, in communist China. Kevin, I want to just touch on that briefly on the other side of a very short break. We'll be right back with more with Kevin Freeman right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In recent days, Chinese military personnel have deliberately endangered American counterparts in international air and sea space. The near collisions were not simply unprofessional or the result of a failure to communicate. They are deliberate provocations that eventually will get someone and maybe a lot of us killed. The incidents reflect the Chinese Communist Party's increasing ability and willingness to take risks in order to assert effective control over areas it claims as sovereign waters and territory. They are also evidence of Beijing's ever less concealed contempt for a U.S. military being fundamentally transformed by the purging of skilled warriors, the promotion of leaders embracing Marxist nostrums designed to divide, weaken, and demoralize those still serving, and a commander-in-chief rightly characterized as a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party. That's a prescription for our defeat in a shooting war Team Biden is inviting. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back. Kevin Freeman is with us for a further part of our conversation with him about economic warfare being waged against our country and the stakes many of us may be unaware are very personal as well as national stakes. Kevin, we were talking about the possibility of a shooting war with China. I pray to God that it won't happen, but I do think that there's a growing body of evidence that suggests it is what Xi Jinping, the dictator of China, has in mind, not just for Taiwan, but for us as well. And I just would ask the question of you, as a guy who knows his way around the markets, what are the chances that if the proverbial balloon goes up, not the silly balloon, as Joe Biden called it, but the military option is executed by Xi Jinping, that American investors will lose their shirts?
Oh, they'll lose everything. I mean, can you imagine if you were invested in Nazi Germany in 1937 or 1938? Your investments were entirely wiped out. Right now, people who are invested in Russian securities can't access their funds because Russia invaded Ukraine, and so everything got frozen. If we get into a shooting war with China, you'll lose everything if you're invested in Chinese-led companies. But that's the least of your risks. The greater risk is the loss of your liberty or the loss of your life. I mean, this is a very serious, this is not just playing with fire. This is playing with fire and dynamite and everything all at once.
Kevin, let me pivot to something, as I say, we value so much about you is you're not only very clear-eyed about threats that we face, challenges, financial, economic, and otherwise, but you're also very, very gifted in terms of thinking about what can be done by even individuals to try to make a difference with respect to those challenges. And a prime example of this is the work that you and your team have been engaged in now for some time on something called the Texas Transactional Currency Initiative. And we've talked about it in the past. There have been a number of developments in the state legislature in your native state of Texas. Remind us why this initiative is so needed, as well as give us an update on where things stand with respect to your efforts to get the state legislature there to bring it to the American people, not just the Texans.
Sure. Frank, the reason that we've created this alternative is because the founders allowed it. It's in the Constitution, Article 1, Section 10. The federal government has the power to print money. We all know that, and we get dirty green pieces of paper put in our wallet, and we think that's money. The founders didn't think that was money. They thought gold and silver was money, and those certificates were supposed to be exchangeable for gold and silver. But Richard Nixon removed us from the gold standard in 1971. It created massive inflation risks from 1971 to the present. The dollar has lost 87% of its purchasing power. And we've racked up $32 trillion worth of debt. And with this deal that McCarthy pushed through, it's going to be even more debt. The problem is that our financial system is not sound based solely on fiat paper money. But the founders left us an alternative. They said states can make gold and silver coins money. And so we created a way to add technology that exists to where you can own gold and silver, use a debit card, and pay for bills and services. It functions now. There's a commercial application, but no state has yet to turn this on. So we went to the Texas legislature, and we asked them with two bills, one in the House and the Senate, and they went further than anyone could imagine because people started to light up and like the idea. We started a little late in the process, and so we got chubbed out, is what they call it. When all the 8,000 bills come in and there's infighting between Democrats and Republicans, and there's even an impeachment of the Attorney General of the state of Texas. But we went so far and had so much good response that we're encouraged that not only can we bring it up in the next legislative session, but we're petitioning the governor to make a special session. At the same time, we're going to other states and saying, you can do this too. And we're beginning a national movement. The response we're getting is over the top excited. People love the concept of using gold and silver in a practical way using modern technology. We had 2.8 million actions taken in our Align Act campaign. People love it. And I think we've got a great future for this.
Especially because within a month or so, as I understand it, the federal government is going to start insinuating this so-called central bank digital currency into the mix. And you have been, again, very clear-eyed in warning about what that might portend. Remind us of it and how the Texas transactional currency or some other state's counterpart might help mitigate the dangers associated with a CBDC, as it's called.
Well, the bad news is the Constitution gives the federal government the right to print money and also to determine the value thereof. They are going to add modern technology and turn in something very, very evil. Central bank digital currency, some people call it Biden bucks. It's literally the money that you have won't be dirty green pieces of paper anymore. They're going to make that go away. What they're going to give you is electronic access like a Bitcoin, but without the privacy and without the limits on the production of it. And the government can control every aspect of your spending. It gives them a line item veto to peer into what you're doing at all times with your money. That's evil, and it opens the door for the opportunity, the government to literally say, you can't spend on that item, or we'll take money away from you and give it to somebody else. This is what they dream of. It's what they wrote about in their working papers in response to President Biden's executive order. Hey, what does CBDC look like? It looks like programmable money controllable by the government. Now, that's bad. But our answer is we can't stop them at the state level. We've got to stop them at the congressional level because that's where the power to create and value money is in Congress. But that Texas alternative, silver and gold, which is real money biblically, historically, constitutionally, that ability gives you an opt-out. You don't have to just rely on federal money. You have a state option. And I believe a lot of people will exit the federal system and go to the state-based system if given the alternative. That's why it's so imperative that we get this up and running as quickly as possible. That's why we're demanding a special session. Please, Governor Abbott, give us a special session. At the same time, I'm going to talk to the National Association of Christian Legislatures and giving them model legislation that they can then take to all sorts of other states. We've had interest from Utah, Oklahoma, South Carolina, Alaska, Michigan, Florida. I'm not thinking of all the states. A lot of states want this alternative. It's in the Constitution, and it gives you an opt-out of real money that can avoid the privacy issues, and you can transact in it in our economy.
When you say avoid the privacy issues, meaning protect the privacy of the users in a way that
correct.
The central
avoid
bank digital
the challenges.
Currency will not. Yeah, Kevin, this is hugely important. And I think the advantage that Texas has over the other states, of course, is that it has an actual functioning repository for holding the gold and silver, but it could make that available, presumably, to these other states as part of its, commercial enterprise. Kevin, you mentioned the impeachment of the Attorney General of Texas, Ken Paxton. I know you know him well. I do a little bit. Tell us what's going on there and why it matters, not just for Texans.
Well, Ken Paxton has proven that he's willing to stand up for Texas and citizens. He sued the Biden administration, so he has lots of enemies. And among those enemies, they want to see him removed from office. And so he has been temporarily removed. He will have a Senate hearing. There are all kinds of charges brought against him, most of which were all out there well before he was elected in a landslide election. So a lot of well-meaning people in Texas are standing behind him and saying, we need that defense from the Attorney General Ken Paxton.
We'll be watching it closely as it plays out. It goes to the Senate next, I'm told, in Harris County for some reason. I haven't had an explanation for why that's the case, not Austin, but we'll look forward to a chat with you about that in the near future. Kevin Freeman, thank you for the work you do at Economic War Room. You and your team are absolutely spectacular national treasures, and we appreciate your visits with us whenever possible. We'll talk with you soon. Be right back with more.
To destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back, and a very special welcome for the first time to Securing America to our next guest. Her name is Tamara Leach. She is a Canadian who was one of the organizers of the Truckers Convoy that formed up in Canada to protest what the government there was doing in the way of mandating vaccinations and otherwise oppressing the people of Canada in connection with the COVID-19 virus. She is the author of a new book, Hold the Line, My Story from the Heart of the Freedom Convoy, as the Truckers Convoy was known. Tamara is a woman who has, for her troubles, for her efforts with the convoy, been subjected to considerable, I think it's fair to say, oppression by the Trudeau government. We're going to talk a little bit about her story with a view to what it means not only for the people of Canada, but also for us here as well. Tamara, welcome. And my condolences on what you've been put through since you exercised your right to express your opposition to government policy, only to discover that you didn't live in a democratic, free Canada any longer, right?
That's correct. And thank you so much for having me. Yes, that's correct. Yep.
So tell us a little bit about the convoy. I think most Americans are familiar with it, but it's, you know, rapidly receding in memory. Who else was involved, and how long did it operate, and why did it upset Justin Trudeau so much?
It certainly did upset him. We had a very small core group of people, Bridget Belton and Chris Barber, came up with the idea of either doing a convoy or some local slow rolls or something. And then as a group, we kind of all decided that we would form a convoy and go to Ottawa to protest against the COVID-19 mandates and restrictions that were affecting every Canadian. Justin now, Trudeau,
you're way out in Western Canada, in Alberta, right?
That's correct. Yes. Yeah. So it took us 5 days to convoy from where I live to Ottawa.
And how did the people of Canada respond to your convoy as you traveled the country?
It was the most beautiful display of humanity and love and unity that I've ever witnessed. We had thousands, hundreds of thousands of people lining the highways and the overpasses. I'm sure you've seen the photos. They were having bonfires in the ditches and blowing off fireworks over us. It was, and it didn't matter. The striking thing about it is that we came through Manitoba and I saw native dancers drumming in full regalia and Sikh gentlemen standing beside them and Hutterite mothers and children beside them and nuns in full habits. And that was the moment that it really hit me that this, it didn't matter what color you were, what god you worshipped, what part of the country you came from. We were all just Canadians.
Mm. And did that apply to political parties as well? Did you find people in Trudeau's Labour Party, for example, who were sympathetic to what you were doing?
There was a few that voiced some concerns of his MPs while we were in Ottawa, but none that still came out to talk to us. And that's all we wanted, was just to have an audience with somebody that so that we could just discuss our concerns and our you know, the harms that were being caused by these restrictions. And the one word that we heard the most was hope. And I don't know what it was like in the States over COVID, but, you know, there people were lost. They were alone. Every single day we heard stories of people that were planning their suicides until we started this convoy.
Wow. Lockdown is, I guess, the operative word that we all were facing on both sides of the border. And tell us a bit about what Justin Trudeau did instead of talking or engaging or listening even to you. What sorts of repercussions did he set in motion? Stark contrast to what I think had been Canadian tolerance and practice in the past, had it not?
Correct. I remember Black Lives Matter had a big rally here during the protest when we were supposed to be protesting, and he showed up and took a knee. One of the first things he said about us was he called us racists and white extremists and white supremacists. You know, his textbook Trudeau came right out of the gate and started name calling and belittling us. And it was interesting.
You are, as I understand it, a Métis, which is not a term probably known to many Americans, but that wouldn't seem to describe you exactly.
No, yeah.
Would it?
Not really, no. I'm definitely not a white supremacist.
What is a Métis?
Métis is French-Canadian and Indigenous mix, yes. So I have an Indigenous background, which is ironic because if I would have been protesting for something that the Trudeau government approved of, I would probably be being flown across the country right now as we speak. That's right. But because it was for something that he didn't agree with, I was persecuted.
Yeah, well, they flew you across the country in shackles, I understand.
Yes, they did. Yes.
As part of their retaliation against you. But more broadly, what did Trudeau do to the convoy to basically put it out of business at the end?
Well, as you probably saw, there was a massive takedown the weekend after my arrest. I was arrested on February the 17th, and he had called in police forces from all across the country, and it was one of the most horrific, violent takedowns I've seen. I was in prison at that point, so I wasn't there in person, but when I got home and I sat on my couch and I watched the footage, I bawled like a baby for 2 days. It was horrific and something that I grew up watching on TV that happened in other countries.
Yeah, in the Soviet Union and
yes.
Communist China, for example. And what were you charged with that put you in jail temporarily, at least?
I've been charged with mischief, counseling to commit mischief, intimidation, and counseling intimidation, which is funny. I'm only 5 feet tall and about 120 pounds, so I don't consider myself very intimidating. A new one on me.
What exactly does that constitute, and why is that illegal?
That constitute, I guess what they're describing it as is we weren't allowing the public to use their public spaces.
The convoy was blocking traffic and otherwise interfering with commerce and so on. Got it.
Yes.
Okay. So they arrested you. They busted up the convoy rather violently. They imposed a variety of other rather draconian measures as well, did they not, the government of Canada, including on speech as well as assembly?
Yes, yes. My conditions are quite broad, and I'm not allowed to log into social media. So I'm allowed no social media. I'm not allowed to speak with some of the
organizations. This is awaiting trial.
This is awaiting trial. I haven't even been found guilty yet. I'm not allowed to protest, organize protests or rallies, or specifically if they're around COVID-19 mandates. It's unbelievable.
Yeah. And to the extent that this is infringing upon your civil liberties, it sounds as though, as you said earlier, that's not a preferred sort of point of view for the Trudeau government, hence you're being restricted. You were actually arrested a second time, and that's where this flight across the country in shackles took place, apparently.
Correct.
You have, in short, lived the experience of repression inside a Western country. And one of the things I just wanted to have you share with us, Tamara, because many Americans are, you know, sympathetic, I'm sure, to your story, but they'll think of it as, oh, well, that's something that's happening in another country, maybe close at hand, but still another country, can't happen here. What would your words of advice be to Americans about whether this same sort of behavior on the part of our government, well, we saw a bit of it, frankly, in our own states, many of them, not all of them, but some. Could that story that you've been describing happen in America as well?
I believe it absolutely can. And I believe that we and you need to be vigilant. We need to continue to hold our governments to account. I think what happened, it seems to me, is that these governments that imposed these draconian measures during COVID-19 got power drunk. And, you know, at the time of the convoy, at least in Canada, they were coming down harder on us with these mandates and lockdowns as the rest of the world was starting to open up, which didn't make any sense. And I believe you guys just actually this or last month ceased the travel mandate across the border.
Yeah. Well, we ended the state of emergency that was claimed for the COVID business, which had that effect, among other things. But I guess what I'm really so concerned about is that the restrictions on freedom that we saw as the application of the so-called China model here and in Canada does have the distinct possibility of being replicated again when the next pandemic or other emergency is declared. And a fear of mine is that it may be declared by a foreign entity like the World Health Organization, not even our own government. But your tale, your story, Tamara Leach, is so important. And I encourage people to get Hold the Line, My Story from the Heart of the Freedom Convoy, not least because it has some very important lessons for us as to what we must not allow to happen here. Thank you for sharing your experiences with us and visiting, and we'll look forward to updates with you in the near future if we can. God bless you. We'll be right back with more right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In recent days, Chinese military personnel have deliberately endangered American counterparts in international air and sea space. The near collisions were not simply unprofessional or the result of a failure to communicate. They are deliberate provocations that eventually will get someone and maybe a lot of us killed. The incidents reflect the Chinese Communist Party's increasing ability and willingness to take risks in order to assert effective control over areas it claims as sovereign waters and territory. They are also evidence of Beijing's ever less concealed contempt for a U.S. military being fundamentally transformed by the purging of skilled warriors, the promotion of leaders embracing Marxist nostrums designed to divide, weaken, and demoralize those still serving, and a commander-in-chief rightly characterized as a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party. That's a prescription for our defeat in a shooting war Team Biden is inviting. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back, and a very special welcome to our next guest, a regular here at Securing America. I'm very pleased to say his name is Bill Walton. He is the host of his own television program, and he brings an extraordinary background to the topics we address, and he often does as well. That would be a recovering maven of Wall Street, a master of the universe. We're always delighted to have his insights into the challenges that we're facing, particularly with respect to the financial underwriting of the Chinese Communist Party by you and other American investors, mostly unwitting. Bill, it's good to have you back. Welcome, sir.
Frank, as always.
Thank you. Let me just start by saying our friend Steve Bannon had a program over the weekend and has advertised, I think, a number of follow-ups that will take place in the course of this week about a company called Sequoia Capital. And I'd like to get your sort of calibration on how big a deal Sequoia Capital is in the venture capital space for the United States and the world.
Well, Sequoia is a very big deal. I mean, Sequoia is the Goldman Sachs and the JP Morgan and whatever financial firm you can think of rolled into one when it comes to venture capital. They've been backing some of the most successful companies for decades. And, you know, the Silicon Valley operates as a cartel, and they're really the leader. And Sequoia has also been a leader in the venture capital investments in China. And as we talked about in the, you know, in the past, and we'll probably keep talking about in the future, the venture capital industry has extensive investments in China. And one of their strategies going into the country is to cozy up to the Chinese Communist Party, because you and I know both every company, public and private, is in essence controlled by the party. They can only do what the party lets them do. And so they've had a strategy to go into China and partner with the party. And to that end, one of their top partners is Neil Chin, who I believe went to Yale and is part of the Yale Center Beijing, which is a constant stream of U.S. investors and other important people in China, and has been one of the keys to developing contacts in that country. Well, in any event, it's quite clear that Neil Chin is not just affiliated with the Communist Party. He's probably a member of the Communist Party by all accounts, and I think that was what was on Bannon's show. Entirely credible. Unfortunately, I fear that Neil Chin is just one of many venture capitalists operating in China with very, very close ties to the party. And now that we're looking at investments in artificial intelligence, advanced semiconductors, and all the other important technologies which we use in our national security and protecting our freedom, these ties with China have become egregious, and we need to shine a white light on it.
They have been coming to Egregious. This one seems to me to be somewhat distinctive in that the guy who is substantially running, as I understand it, Sequoia China, if not Sequoia Capital more generally, Neil Shen, has actually been directly advising the Politburo. In fact, the guy that was interviewed by Steve the other day, Brian Costello, talks about him as being basically an employee of the Chinese Communist Party, as well as, Sequoia. And Bill, I guess what strikes me is perhaps not unprecedented, but egregious at least, is to the extent that he is involved in moving American investors' money. And I'm talking about not just big deal investors like the guys you used to work with, but also, public pension funds but, into companies that are working for the Chinese Communist Party, including the People's Liberation Army. And he's doing it from a vantage point of being a guy, ostensibly an American working for, Americans. It just makes my head explode.
This is not their money that Sequoia is investing. I mean, yes, the partners have big investments in their own fund. That's typical. But Sequoia raises money from institutional investors, and those include all the pension funds, teachers union, California State pension fund, Florida for a while was in this. And so all the major pension funds. And the pension funds are representing whose money? Well, ordinary Americans. And, we've talked about the problems of mutual funds investing in public companies in China. We'll double that down in spades when it comes to private equity and venture capital investing. It's not a direct investment that individuals are making, but through their pension funds. And, the colleges, major universities are in it. And, virtually everyone has been flocking to China for the last decade or two. And so I think we're now that the naked agenda of the Chinese Communist Party, which is, putting it mildly, almost like world domination, our involvement there is extremely problematic. And these venture funds are right at the heart of the matter. And it goes deeper. I mean, Jim Breyer runs Sequoia, I think he's one of the key partners. And he's got a friend who's a Sequoia professor of human artificial intelligence, who Chinese, called Fei-Fei Lai, who is deeply involved with the power structure in China. So the lines are blurred, or the lines are completely non-existent when it comes to China and U.S. Interests.
Well, except to the extent that there's a line between, the people who seek world domination and our destruction and us. And that's the thing that's so worrying. And I don't disagree with what you've said, Bill. This has been a problem that's been building for a long time. Xi Jinping has simply taken the mask off, the so-called hide and bide strategy of Deng Xiaoping. But this has been the game all along. It's just that the game is now at a point where it's quite possibly about to move into a shooting war phase. And as we talk about most weeks, under those circumstances, whatever Neil Shen and his ilk are up to is likely to translate into huge losses for American investors, point one. And point two, the fruits of those investments are likely to be returned to us, if you will, through military, weaponry that was financed, in effect, by those.
Well, our technology is probably already baked into a lot of the Chinese.
We have to hold you. Hold the thought. We'll be right back with Bill Walton right after this. Welcome back. We're visiting with Bill Walton, as we do each week about this time, for which we're very grateful. Bill is deeply engaged, as always, in tracking what is going on with respect to the Chinese Communist Party, but also what we're doing to enable it. We've been talking about Neil Shen, Bill, and I wanted to pivot to another master of the universe, Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan. He's just had a little party for 2,500 American and other international business leaders in China. He seems all in. Is he not getting the memo that there are real problems here or what?
Well, by way of background, JP Morgan, along with all the other major security firms, commercial banks, have been gaining a toehold in what they hope will be a $60 trillion savings market, investment market in China. They've got full control of a mutual fund joint venture this year. They've got a futures unit. They've got a securities business they've added in 2021. And they also got approval to invest another 270 billion won in the Chinese Merchant Bank asset management subsidiary. So they're very, very interested in China. The problem is China is becoming less interested in them. And, you know, we've seen with Xi, he's cracking down on all the industries, the big tech firms, the private tutoring companies. He's cutting down, he's shutting down due diligence firms in China. And Jamie and the other guys running these big companies are not dumb men. They understand which way the wind's blowing. They also understand that we may end up in a shooting war in Taiwan. And they're now, and he was recently interviewed on Bloomberg, he now is sort of saying things like, well, we're very interested in being a friend of the Chinese people. He didn't say party. But if national security interests are prevail, we're American patriots, and we're going to do the right thing. But as you point out, in the meantime, they're hosting a party for 2,500 of their closest friends from 37 countries over a two-day conference. Hope they'll develop relationships and do more in China, not less. It's become very thorny for him and the other guys that have been deeply involved here. And they're going to have to make some choices pretty soon, because Xi seems intent on heating this thing up, in particular going after Taiwan.
Yeah. Well, and maybe us too. Bill, one of the things that is clear is at the same time as Xi is taking these steps to make the investing environment more challenging, shall we say, the message is nonetheless being conveyed, especially through these kinds of interlocutors, these friends of China, that it's open for business, that we need to stay very much engaged with China and China with us, that we're, you know, conjoined like Siamese twins, I think is the way Elon Musk, one of the other of these titans of American business, has put it. He's deeply invested in China with Tesla and his battery plants and so on. Talk a little bit about Elon Musk and where he sits in this difficult position at the moment.
Well, as always, Elon Musk is a fascinating and I'd say entertaining story. Well, Jamie Dimon and the other financial titans meet in China more or less quietly with professional people. Elon shows up in China as a rock star, and he's feted all over the country. Went to a 16-course dinner in one of the most expensive, fancy restaurants in Beijing. Social media is alive with love with him. And you're right. He has Tesla, is deeply involved in China, both manufacturing and in selling cars in China. And it's a critical, important strategic relationship for Musk, and I might add, and for China. But then there's this stubborn fact that Twitter, which Elon Musk also owns, Twitter is not allowed in China. And so that's really, I think that puts in high relief the problems we've got in dealing with China. On the one hand, we've got these commercial interests. On the other, China, as we know, is completely shut down speech and movement. And they're also clamping down on the Chinese use of their bank accounts. So that's, and Elon wanders right into that with his charm and rock star presence. And It'll be interesting to see next year, 12 months from now, what the Chinese think of Elon, how that relationship's evolved and what they've done about Twitter. It's a story we definitely need to follow.
Well, we do. And in particular, Bill, because one of the things Elon has asserted in his inimitable showman manner is that the leading company in the world, by far, in terms of its use of artificial intelligence, is Tesla.
Yeah.
And to the extent that Tesla is, if not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Chinese Communist Party, approaching that status, it seems, it certainly would suggest that China is going to be gaining access to artificial intelligence at the very moment that we're increasingly hearing from people who are leaders of that sector that this thing is a Frankenstein's monster that is now becoming more and more ominous by the day. I mean, you had a number of them signing a letter saying it may pose an existential threat akin to nuclear war. Is this really a good idea for the United States?
Frank, China seems to be doing with Elon Musk what it's done with company after company after company over the last two decades, is that they brought Elon in, they brought Tesla in, and oh yeah, there's this little thing called artificial intelligence, which Tesla is becoming a leader in, and I'm sure they've studied and grabbed that technology. And now that's why I say stay tuned, because Tesla is now seeing competition from Chinese-made electrical vehicles. And they've got a plant in Shanghai that they hope to expand, but for some reason, the permitting has been slow to come. And so there's all sorts of noise on this horizon, which we, as I said, we need to pay a lot of attention to. Bottom line, though, I think it signals Xi's clear intention to decouple China from us and the rest of the world economy to the extent he can, so he has freedom to
engage
in his kinetic adventures.
Exactly right. Bill Walton, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for this tour d'horizon of some of the people that China is being helped by.
There's a lot going on, Frank.
There always is. We'll be back to you with more soon. We'll be back to the rest of you again next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.